But now, at the council held on Wednesday evening, a dispatch from Jeb Stuart announced that McDowell, with nothing at all between him and a junction with McClellan, had halted his men and was countermarching them back toward the Rappahannock. It seemed entirely too good to be true, yet there it was. Johnston breathed a sigh of relief and canceled tomorrow's attack. That was why Davis heard no gunfire when he rode out next morning, expecting to find the battle in full swing. Johnston did not abandon his intention to wreck one wing of McClellan's divided army, but he was doubly thankful for the delay. For one thing, it gave him additional time, and no matter how he squandered that commodity while backing up, time was something he prized highly whenever he considered moving forward. For another, with McDowell no longer a hovering threat, he could shift the attack to the south bank of the Chickahominy, where the Federals were less numerous and reportedly more open to assault. With this in mind, he drew up a plan of battle utilizing three roads that led eastward out of the capital so patly that they might have been surveyed for just this purpose. In the center was the Williamsburg Road, paralleling the York River Railroad to the Chickahominy Crossing 12 miles out. On the left was the 9 Mile Road, which turned southeast to intersect the railroad at Fair Oaks Station and the Williamsburg Road at Seven Pines, halfway to Bottoms Bridge. On the right, branching south from the Williamsburg Road about 2 miles out, was the Charles City Road, which reached a junction 6 miles southeast, leading north to Seven Pines and Fair Oaks. Thus, all three roads converged upon the objective, where the advance elements of the Federal left wing were entrenched. The attack could be launched with all the confidence of a bowler rolling 3 balls at once, each one down a groove that had been cut to yield a strike. A third advantage of the delay was that it brought in reinforcements. R.H. Anderson's command, at the end of its long withdrawal from the line of the Rappahannock, was combined with the brigade that had been thrown out of Hanover Courthouse, thus creating a new division for A.P. Hill, a 37-year-old Virginia West Pointer just promoted to Major General. Another division was on the way from Petersburg under Huger, who had stopped there after evacuating Norfolk. These additions would bring Johnston's total strength to nearly 75,000 men, giving him the largest army yet assembled under the Stars and Bars. What was more, the 6 divisions were ideally located to fit the plan of battle. A.P. Hill and Magruder, north of Richmond, could maintain their present positions, guarding the upper Chickahominy crossings. Smith and Longstreet were camped in the vicinity of Fairfield Racecourse, where the 9 Mile Road began. Longstreet would move all the way down it to strike the Union right near Fair Oaks, while Smith halted in reserve, facing left as he did so, to guard the lower river crossings. D.H. Hill was east of the city, well out the Williamsburg Road. He would advance and deliver a frontal attack on signal from Huger, who had the longest march, coming up from the south on the Charles City Road. The object was to maul Keyes, then maul Heintzelman in turn as he came up, leaving McClellan a single wing to fly on. It was a simple matter, as such things went, to direct the attacking divisions to their separate unobstructed routes. On the evening of May 30th, as Johnston did so, a pelting rainstorm broke, mounting quickly to unprecedented violence and continuing far into the night. This would no doubt slow tomorrow's marches on the heavy roads and add to the difficulty of deploying in the sodden fields, but it would also swell the Chickahominy still farther and increase the likelihood that the Federal right wing would be flood-bound on the northern bank, cut off from rendering any help to the assailed left wing across the river. Johnston was glad to see the rain come down and glad to see it continue. This was Confederate weather at its best. Some of the instructions to his 6 division commanders were sent in writing. Others were given orally, in person. In either case, he stipulated that the attack, designed to throw 23 of the 27 southern brigades against a single northern corps, was to be launched early in the morning, as early as practicable, he added, hearing the drumming of the rain. The most remarkable thing about the ensuing action was that a plan as sound as Johnston's appeared at the outset, so simple and forthright, indeed, as to be practically foolproof even for green troops under green commanders, could produce such an utter brouhaha, such a Donnybrook of a battle. Seven Pines, or Fair Oaks, as some called it, was unquestionably the worst-conducted large-scale conflict in a war that afforded many rivals for that distinction. What it came to, finally, was a military nightmare, not so much because of the suffering and bloodshed, though there was plenty of both before it was over, but rather because of the confusion, compounded by delay. Longstreet began it. Since his assigned route out the 9-mile road would put him under Smith, who outranked him, he persuaded Johnston to give him command of the forces on the right. As next-ranking man, he was entitled to it, he said, and Johnston genially agreed, on condition that control would revert to him when the troops converged on Seven Pines. Longstreet, thus encouraged, decided to transfer his division to the Williamsburg Road, which would give him unhampered freedom from Smith and add to the weight of D.H. Hill's assault on the Union center. He did not inform Johnston of this decision, however, and that was where the trouble first began. Marching south on the outskirts of Richmond, across the mouth of the 9-mile road, he held up Smith's lead elements while his 6 brigades of infantry trudged past with all their guns and wagons. This in itself amounted to a considerable delay, but Longstreet was by no means through. When Huger prepared to enter the Williamsburg Road, which led to his assigned route down the Charles City Road, he found Longstreet's 14,000-man division to his front, passing single file over an improvised bridge across a swollen creek. Nor would the officers in charge of the column yield the right of way. First come, first served, they said. When Huger protested, Longstreet informed him that he ranked him. They stood there in the morning sunlight, the South Carolina aristocrat and the broad, hairy Georgian, and that was the making of one career and the wrecking of another. Huger accepted the claim as true, though it was not, and bided his time while Longstreet took the lead. The morning sun climbed up the sky, and now it was Johnston's turn to listen, as Davis had done 2 days ago, for the boom of guns that remained silent. As he waited with Smith, whose 5 brigades were in position 2 miles short of Fair Oaks Station, his anxiety was increased by the fact that he had lost one of his divisions as completely as if it had marched unobserved into quicksand. Nobody at headquarters knew where Longstreet was, nor any of his men, and when a staff officer galloped down the 9-mile road to find him, he stumbled into the enemy lines and was captured. When at last Longstreet and his troops were found, they were halted beside the Williamsburg Road, 2 miles out of Richmond, while Huger's division filed past to enter the Charles City Road. Johnston could only presume that Longstreet had misinterpreted last night's verbal orders. The delay could be ruinous. Everything depended on the action being completed before nightfall. If it went past that, McClellan would bring up reinforcements under cover of darkness and counterattack with superior numbers in the morning. As the sun went past the overhead, Johnston remarked that he wished his army was back in its suburban camps, and the thing had never begun. He could no more stop it, however, than he could get it started. All he could do was wait, and the waiting continued. Lee rode out from Richmond, determined not to spend another day like the office-bound day of Manassas. Johnston greeted him courteously, but spared him the details of the mix-up. Presently there came from the southeast an intermittent, far-sounding rumble of cannon. It grew until just after 3 o'clock, with 10 of the 15 hours of daylight gone. The rumble was vaguely intensified by a sound that Lee believed was musketry. No, no, Johnston told him, it was only an artillery duel. Lee did not insist, although it seemed to him that the subdued accompaniment was rising in volume. Then at 4 o'clock a note came from Longstreet. informing the army commander that he was heavily engaged in front of Seven Pines and wanted support on his left. That was the signal Johnston had been awaiting, ordering Smith's lead division to continue down the 9-mile road until it struck the Federal right. He spurred ahead to study the situation at first hand. As he rode off, the president rode up, so that some observers later said that the general had left in haste to avoid an irksome meeting. Davis asked Lee what the musketry meant. Had he heard it too? Lee asked. Unmistakably, Davis said. What was it? Mostly, it was D.H. Hill. He had been in position for 6 hours, awaiting the signal from Huger as instructed, when at 2 o'clock he ran out of patience and surged forward on his own. It was just as well, otherwise the wait would have been interminable. Cutting cross-country to take his assigned position on Hill's right, Huger had become involved in the upper reaches of White Oak Swamp. He would remain so all through what was left of this unhappy Saturday, as removed from the battle, except that the guns were roaring within earshot, as if he had been with Jackson out in the Shenandoah Valley. Hill's attack was no less furious for being unsupported on the flanks. A 40-year-old North Carolinian, a West Point professional turned schoolmaster as a result of ill health, he was a caustic hater of all things Northern and an avid critic of whatever displeased him anywhere at all. Dyspeptic as Stonewall Jackson, his brother-in-law, he suffered also from a spinal ailment, which gave him an unmilitary bearing, whether mounted or afoot. His friends called him Harvey, that was his middle name, a hungry-looking man with haunted eyes and a close-cropped, scraggly beard. He took a fierce delight in combat, especially when it was hand-to-hand, as now. His assault swept over the advanced Federal redoubt, taking 8 guns and a brigade camp with all its equipment and supplies. Scarcely pausing to reform his line, he went after the rest of Keyes's corps, which was drawn up to receive him just west of Seven Pines. Here, too, the fight was furious, the Federals having the advantage of an abattis previously constructed along the edge of a line of woods, while the Confederates, emerging from a flooded swamp, had to charge unsupported across an open space to reach them. Longstreet's complaint, made presently when he appealed to Johnston for help on the left, that Green troops were as sensitive about the flanks as a virgin, did not apply to Hill's men today. Especially it did not apply to the lead brigade, 4 regiments from Alabama and 1 from Mississippi, under Brigadier General Robert E. Rhodes. Inexperienced as they were, their only concern was the tactics manual definition of the mission of the infantry in attack. To close with the enemy and destroy him. Advancing through the swamp, thigh-deep in mud and stagnant water, they propped their wounded against the trunks of trees to keep them from drowning, and came on, yelling as they came. They reached the abattis, pierced it, and drove the bluecoats back again. It was gallantly done, but at a dreadful cost. Rhodes's 2,000-man command, for instance, lost 1,094 killed, wounded, or drowned. And there were no replacements near at hand. Out of 13 brigades available to Longstreet here on the right, his 6, Hill's 4, and Huger's 3, less than half went into action. 3 of his 6 he had sent to follow Huger into the ooze of White Oak Swamp, and a 4th he had posted on the left to guard against a surprise attack, in spite of the fact that there was nothing in that direction except the other half of the Confederate army. However, the Federals were forming a new line farther back, perhaps with a counterattack in mind, and he was not so sure. Huger was lost on the right, so might Smith be lost on the left. At any rate, that was when he sent the note to Johnston, appealing for the protection of his virginal left flank. Smith's division, reinforced by 4 brigades from Magruder and A.P. Hill, followed the army commander down the 9-mile road toward Fair Oaks, where the leading elements were formed under his direction for a charge that was intended to strike the exposed right flank of Keyes, whose center was at Seven Pines, less than a mile away. Late as the hour was, Johnston's juggernaut attack plan seemed at last to be rolling toward a repetition of his triumph at Manassas. But not for long. aimed at Keyes, it struck instead a substantial body of men in muddy blue who stood and delivered massed volleys that broke up the attack before it could gather speed. They were strangers to this ground. The mud stains on their uniforms were from the Chickahominy Bottoms. It was Sumner's Corps, arrived from across the river. Commander of the 1st U.S. Cavalry, while Albert Sidney Johnston commanded the 2nd, Joe Johnston was his lieutenant colonel, McClellan one of his captains. Sumner was an old army man with an old army notion that orders were received to be obeyed, not questioned, no matter what obstacles stood in the way of execution. Bull Sumner, he was called, in full the Bull of the Woods, because of the loudness of his voice. He had a peacetime custom of removing his false teeth to give commands that carried from end to end of the regiment above the thunder of hoofs. Alerted soon after midday, Johnston's aide, who had ridden into the Union lines in search of Longstreet, had told his captors nothing, but his presence was suspicious, and the buildup in the woods and swamps out front had been growing more obvious every hour. Sumner assembled his corps on the north bank near the two bridges he had built for this emergency. Foaming water had buckled them, torn from their pilings, awash knee-deep in the center, they seemed about to go with the flood. When the order to support Keyes arrived and the tall white-haired old man started his soldiers across, an engineer officer protested that the condition of the bridges made a crossing not only unsafe but impossible.
"Impossible!" Sumner roared. "Sir, I tell you I can cross. I am ordered."
Marching toward the sound of firing, he got his men over the swaying bridges and across the muddy bottoms, on to Fair Oaks and the meeting engagement which produced on both sides, in about equal parts, feelings of elation and frustration. If Sumner had kept going, he would have struck the flank of Longstreet. If Smith had kept going, he would have struck the flank of Keyes. As it was, they struck each other, and the result was a stalemate. Smith could make no headway against Sumner, who was content to hold his ground. Hill, to the south, had shot his bolt, and Keyes was thankful that the issue was not pressed beyond the third line he had drawn while waiting for Heintzelman, who had sent one division forward to help him but did not bring the other up till dusk. By then the battle was practically over. Seven Pines, the Southerners called it, since that was where they scored their gains. To the Northerners it was Fair Oaks for much the same reason. The attackers had the advantage in spoils, 10 guns, 6,000 rifles, 347 prisoners, and a good deal of miscellaneous equipment from the captured camp. But the price was excessive. 6,134 Confederates were dead or wounded, well over 1,000 more than the 5,031 Federals who had fallen. These were the end figures, not known or attained until later, but they included one casualty, whose fall apparently tipped the balance considerably further in favor of the Yankees. Near Fair Oaks, Johnston watched as the uproar swelled to a climax. Then, as it diminished, he rode closer to the battle line, and, perceiving that nothing more could be accomplished, the flame-stabbed dusk was merging into twilight, sent couriers to instruct the various commanders to have their men cease firing, sleep on their arms in line of battle, and prepare to renew the contest in the morning. Just then he was hit in the right shoulder by a bullet. As he reeled in the saddle, a shell fragment struck him in the chest and unhorsed him. Two aides carried the unconscious general to a less exposed position and were lifting him onto a stretcher when the president and Lee came riding up. As they dismounted and approached, Johnston opened his eyes and smiled. Davis knelt and took his hand, beginning to express his regret that the general had been hit. This affecting scene was interrupted, however, by Johnston's shock at discovering that he had lost his sword and pistols. The unblemished sword of which he had written in protest at being overslewed by the man who now held his hand, and murmured condolences. "I would not lose it for $10,000, he said earnestly. "Will not someone please go back and get it and the pistols for me?" They waited then while a courier went back under fire, found the arms where they had fallen, and returned them to Johnston, who rewarded him by giving him one of the pistols. This done, the stretcher-bearers took up their burden and set off. Davis and Lee went looking for Smith, who, as the next-ranking field commander, would now take charge of the uncompleted battle. Presently they found him, but the man they found bore little resemblance to the stern-lipped, confident G.W., who the month before had urged an all-or-nothing assault on Philadelphia and New York. He had learned of Johnston's misfortune, and he counted it as his own. It made him tremble. He looked sick. In fact, he was sick. Not from fear, or anyhow not from any ordinary fear. He was brave as the next man in battle, if not braver. But from the strain of responsibility suddenly loaded on his shoulders. The effect was paralyzing, quite literally, for within 2 days he would leave the army, suffering from an affliction of the central nervous system. Just now, when Davis asked what his plans were, he replied that he had none. First, he would have to discover Longstreet's situation on the right, of which he knew nothing. He might have to withdraw. On the other hand, he might be able to hold his ground. Davis suggested that he take the latter course. The Federals might fall back in the night. If the Confederates stayed, they would gain the moral effect of a victory. Smith said he would if he could. The best that could be hoped for under present circumstances was that the army would be able to disengage itself tomorrow without further excessive losses for a future effort under a new commander. As Davis and Lee rode together up the 9-mile road, clogged like all the others tonight with wounded and disheartened men who had stumbled and hobbled out of the day-long nightmare of bungled marches and mismanaged firefights, one thing at least was clear. The new commander would not be Smith, who had had retreat in the front of his mind before he even knew the situation. The two men rode in silence under a sickle moon. Davis was making his choice. If he hesitated, there was little wonder. His companion was the obvious candidate, but he could easily be bypassed. Davis, knowing better than anyone how well Lee had served in his present advisory capacity, could as logically keep him there as he kept Samuel Cooper at the adjutant general's post. Evacuating Lee, the press had called the 55-year-old graybeard, and with cause. Disappointing lofty expectations, he had shown a woeful incapacity to deal with high-strung subordinates in the field, and Johnston's army had perhaps the greatest number of high-strung troop commanders per square yard of any army ever assembled. Besides, in the more than 13 months of war, Lee had never taken part in a general engagement. Today, in fact, riding about the field as an observer, he had been under close-up rifle fire for the first time since Chapultepec, nearly 15 years ago. Nevertheless, by the time the lights of beleaguered Richmond came in sight, Davis had made his decision. In a few words lost to history, but large with fate for the two riders and their country, he informed Lee that he would be given command of the army known thereafter as the Army of Northern Virginia. In a telegram to McClellan, written while the guns were roaring around Seven Pines and Sumner was assembling his corps for its march across the Chickahominy, Lincoln described the geometrical dilemma he had created for the Confederates in the Shenandoah Valley. "A circle whose circumference shall pass through Harper's Ferry, Front Royal, and Strasburg, and whose center shall be a little northeast of Winchester, almost certainly has within it this morning the forces of Jackson, Ewell, and Edward Johnson. Quite certainly they were within it 2 days ago. Some part of their forces attacked Harper's Ferry at dark last evening, and are still in sight this morning. Shields, with McDowell's advance, retook Front Royal at 11 a.m. yesterday and saved the bridge. Fremont, from the direction of Moorfield, promises to be at or near Strasburg at 5 p.m. today. Banks, at Williamsport with his old force and his new force at Harper's Ferry, is directed to cooperate." He added, by way of showing that the picture was brightening all over, "Corinth is certainly in the hands of General Halleck." The circle was not quite complete, however. There was still the Front Royal Strasburg gap, and Jackson, who knew as well as Lincoln that for him, as for the blue columns attempting a convergence, the question was one of legs, was making for it with all the speed he could coax from his gray marchers. Leaving the Stonewall Brigade to continue the demonstration against Harper's Ferry, he had boarded the train yesterday at Charlestown for a fast ride to Winchester, where the rest of the army was being assembled for the race up the valley turnpike. Time was running out now, and he knew it. Still, nothing in his manner showed distress. Folding his arms on the back of the seat ahead, he rested his face on them and went to sleep. He was wakened by a mounted courier who flagged the train to a stop and handed him a message through the window. Jackson read it without comment, then tore it up and dropped the pieces on the floor. "Go on, sir, if you please," he told the conductor. He put his head on his arms again and soon was rocked to sleep by the vibration of the train. At Winchester, when the other passengers learned the contents of the dispatch that had been delivered en route, they wondered that Stonewall had not blenched. Shields had turned the tables on him. Marching fast from the east through Manassas Gap, the leader of McDowell's advance had surprised the Front Royal garrison, a regiment of Georgians whose colonel fled at the first alarm, leaving his men and $300,000 worth of captured goods to be scooped up by the Yankees. Jackson interviewed the runaway colonel that night. "How many men did you have killed?" "None." "How many wounded?" "None, sir." "Do you call that much of a fight?" And put him in arrest. Fortunately, the senior captain had taken command, burned the supplies, and brought the troops out. But the damage was done, and the implications were ominous. Shields stood squarely across the entrance to the narrow eastern valley with its many avenues of escape through the passes of the Blue Ridge. Stonewall's only remaining line of retreat was up the valley pike, through Strasburg. At Front Royal, Shields was only 11 miles from there. Jackson, at Winchester with his wagon train and prisoners and the main body of his army, was 17. Worst of all, the Stonewall Brigade, still menacing Harper's Ferry, had 44 miles to go before it reached that midpoint in the narrowing gap where Shields and Fremont would converge. Jackson sent a staff officer to bring up the brigade with all possible speed. "I will stay in Winchester until you get here if I can," he told him, "but if I cannot and the enemy gets here first, you must bring it around through the mountains." The army was moving by dawn, May 31st. First the wagon train, a double column 8 miles long, loaded with captured goods that were literally priceless. Then the prisoners, a brigade-sized throng of men in blue who, having missed the pell-mell northward retreat from here to the Potomac the week before, would march faster under Jackson than they had ever done before. And finally the main body, the foot cavalry, already looking a little larger than life because of the fame they were beginning to share with their strange captain. By early afternoon they had cleared the town, all but a couple of cavalry regiments left to wait for the Stonewall Brigade. Winchester's 7 days of liberation were about over. Ahead lay Strasburg, which they might or might not clear before Lincoln's steel circumference was closed. They did not worry about that, however. They left such worries to Jackson, who knew best how to handle them. The worst it could mean was fighting, and they had fought before. Nor did they worry about the rain, a slow drizzle that gave promise of harder showers to come. In fact, they welcomed it. They had the macadamized pike to march on while their opponents slogged through mud. Press on, men," Stonewall urged them. They pressed on, halting for 10 minutes out of every hour as prescribed, and joking among themselves that Jackson would never allow the train to be captured. He had his reserve supply of lemons in one of the wagons. Presently, sure enough, good news was passed back down the line. The head of the column had entered Strasburg and found the gap unclosed. To the east and west, the cavalry was skirmishing within earshot, but the infantry saw no sign of bluecoats as they swung into sight of the little town and made camp for the night. 18 miles they had marched today, despite the long wait for the wagons and the prisoners to clear the road ahead, and now they had reached the rim of the map-drawn circle. They were into the clear. Good news came from the rear as well. By midnight, the Stonewall Brigade was 4 miles south of Winchester, the men dropping dog-tired in their tracks after a record-breaking march of 35 miles. Next morning, they were off again on wobbly legs, cursing their old commander for having left them far in the rear to fight the whole compounded Yankee army. Always he gave them the dirty end of the stick, lest he be accused of favoritism, and now they were to be sacrificed for the sake of this glory hunter's mad gyrations. So they complained. Approaching Strasbourg, however, they heard a spatter of musketry from the west, mixed in with the boom of guns. It was Jackson, fighting to hold the gap ajar for the men of his old brigade. Their hearts were lifted. Once more they sang his praises. "Old Jack knows what he's about. He'll take care of us, you bet." It was a strange day, this June 1st Sunday, particularly for Ewell. Except for a feint by one brigade, repulsed the afternoon before, Shields seemed to be resting content with the retaking of Front Royal. But Fremont was hovering dangerously close in the opposite direction, as if he were tensing his muscles for a leap at the west flank of the long column. Ewell was given the task of holding him back while the Stonewall Brigade caught up with the main body, plodding southward up the pike behind the train and the leg-weary captives. He was warned not to bring on a general engagement. All Jackson wanted was a demonstration that would encourage the Pathfinder to hesitate long enough for the Stonewall Brigade to pass through Strasbourg. The warning seemed superfluous, however. Contact was established early, but nothing would provoke Fremont into close-up fighting. He stopped as soon as his skirmishers came under fire. If Fremont was not provoked, Ewell was. "I can't make out what those people are about," he said. "They won't advance but stay out there in the woods making a great fuss with their guns." Taylor suggested that he place his brigade on the Federal flank and then see what developed. "Do so," old Baldy told him. "That may stir them up, and I am sick of this fiddling about." Taylor gained the position he wanted, then walked down Fremont's line of battle until he came under fire from Ewell's other brigades. There he stopped, and they came up alongside him. Fremont gave ground, refusing to be provoked into what he evidently thought was rashness. After all that marching, 70 miles in 7 days, lashed by rain and pelted by hail as he picked his way over mountain roads, the Pathfinder seemed to want no part of what he had been marching toward. It was strange. At last, about mid-afternoon, the Stonewall Brigade passed Strasbourg. Ewell broke off the fight, if it could be called that, and followed the main body up the turnpike. Fremont again became aggressive, slashing so savagely at the rear of the moving column that Taylor's men and the cavalry had all they could do to hold them off. Up front, Jackson was having his troubles, too. 12 miles beyond Strasbourg, a portion of the train fell into confusion and presently was overtaken by the lead brigade. The result was turmoil, a seemingly inextricable mix-up of wagons and men and horses. Stonewall came riding up and rebuked the infantry commander. "Colonel, why do you not get your brigade together, keep it together, and move on?" "It's impossible, General. I can't do it." "Don't say it's impossible. Turn your command over to the next officer. If he can't do it, I'll find someone who can if I have to take him from the ranks." He got the tangle straightened out and pressed on southward under a scud of angry-looking clouds and jagged streaks of lightning. Soon after sunset, the tempest broke. Rain came down in torrents. Near Strasbourg, Fremont called a halt for the night, wiring Lincoln, "Terrible storm of thunder and hail now passing over. Hailstones as large as hen's eggs." Jackson kept moving, having just received word that he was now involved in another race. McDowell had joined Shields at Front Royal and had sent him south up the Luray Valley to parallel Jackson's advance on the opposite side of Massanutten Mountain. If Shields marched fast, he would intercept the rebels as they came around the south end of the ridge, or he might cross it, marching from Luray to Newmarket, and thus strike the flank of the Gray Column moving along the turnpike. Either way, Jackson would have to stop and deploy, and Fremont could then catch up and attack his rear, supported perhaps by Banks, who had re-entered Winchester, urged by Lincoln to lend a hand in accomplishing Jackson's destruction. Once more it was a question of legs, and Stonewall was duly thankful for the downpour. Even though it bruised his men with phenomenal hailstones, it would deepen the mud in the eastern valley and swell the south fork of the Shenandoah, which lay between Shields and the mountain. To make certain he did not cross it, Jackson sent a detail to burn the bridges west of Luray. That way he would have only Fremont to deal with, at least until he passed Harrisonburg. When he finally stopped for the night, the Sabbath was over. He could write a letter to his wife. "The Federals endeavored to get in my rear by moving on both flanks of my gallant army," he told her. "But our God has been my guide and saved me from their grasp." And he added, with a tenderness that would have shocked the men he had been driving southward through rain and hail, under sudden forks of lightning, "You must not expect long letters from me in such busy times as these, but always believe your husband never forgets his little darling." All next day the rain poured down. "Our God," as Stonewall called him, continued to smile on the efforts of the men in gray. Jackson, never one to neglect an advantage, continued to press the march of his reunited army along the all-weather pike. There was an off chance that Shields, within earshot of Fremont's guns as he slogged through the mud in the opposite valley, might somehow have managed to rebuild the Luray bridges and thereby have gained access to the road across the mountain. A staff officer, sent to check on the work of destruction, returned and reported it well done, but Jackson did not rest easy until he entered Newmarket with the advance and found the mountain road empty. Meanwhile, far back down the pike, the rear guard was having its hands full. Shields had sent his troopers around through Strasburg to cooperate with Fremont, and they were doing their work with dash and spirit. Several times that day they charged the Confederate rear guard, throwing it into confusion. Late in the afternoon they made their most effective attempt, breaking through the scattered ranks and riding hard up the pike until they struck a Virginia regiment, which had halted to receive them with massed volleys. The result was as if they had ridden into a tripwire. Saddles were emptied and horses went down screaming. All except one of the attackers were killed or captured. That night, reporting the incident to Jackson, the Virginia colonel expressed his regret at having had to deal so harshly with such gallantry. The general heard him out, then asked, "Colonel, why did you say you saw those Federal soldiers fall with regret?" Surprised at Stonewall's inability to appreciate chivalrous instincts, the colonel said that it was because he admired their valor. He hated to have to slaughter such brave men. "No," Jackson said dryly. "Shoot them all. I do not wish them to be brave." He had in mind the expectation that he would soon be facing them in battle. Not a series of piecemeal rearguard actions fought to gain time for retreating, but a full-scale conflict into which he would throw every soldier in his army. Having employed defensive tactics to escape the first and second traps at Strasburg and Newmarket, he now was thinking of ways to assume the offensive in dealing with the third, which he would encounter somewhere beyond Harrisonburg when he rounded the south end of Massanutten. At that point he might be able to turn on one or another of the Federal columns and give it a mauling before the other could come to its relief. He would await developments. Meanwhile, that was what he had in mind. Before it could be attempted, however, he would have to give his men a chance to rest. Next day, June 3rd, they got it. The North Fork of the Shenandoah intersected the Valley Turnpike just above the railroad terminus at Mount Jackson, and as Fremont's advance approached that place, the last gray cavalrymen crossed the bridge and set it afire, leaving their pursuers stranded on the northern bank. Stonewall took advantage of this to give his men a full day's badly needed rest, and the wagon train and prisoners a substantial head start toward the Virginia Central, where they could be loaded for shipment by rail to warehouses and prisons down near Richmond. If there seemed to be a considerable risk in this delay, he felt he could afford it. Beyond the mountain, Shields was toiling through the mud. He would be at least a day behind and badly worn by the time he reached Conrad's store, where he would re-enter the tactical picture. On this side, there was the danger that Fremont might bridge the swollen river. He had brought a pontoon train across the Alleghenies for just such an emergency. But Jackson doubted if this could be successful, considering all the water that was trickling down the slopes of all the mountains. It was not. Fremont got his pontoon bridge across, all right, but before he could make much use of it, the North Fork rose 12 feet in 4 hours. He had to cut it loose from the southern bank to keep it from being swept away and lost in the raging water. While his men were taking their ease beyond New Market and leg-weary stragglers were catching up to share in the first hot meals the army had had since leaving Winchester 4 days ago, Jackson took out his valley map and resumed his study of geography. As always, the harder he looked, the more he saw. Resting against the southern face of Massanutten, there was a road net triangle much like the one at the opposite end, which he had used to discomfort Banks. And as Stonewall pored over the map, he began to see possibilities for using this upper triangle in an even more ambitious venture against Shields and Fremont. Its base ran from Harrisonburg to Conrad's store. Its apex was at Port Republic, which lay at the tip of a tongue of land where North and South rivers joined to form the South Fork of the Shenandoah. A bridge spanned North River, connecting the town with Harrisonburg 9 miles away, but all the other crossings were badly swollen fords. Once the South Fork Bridge at Conrad's store was destroyed, this upper bridge at Port Republic would be Shields's only way of joining Fremont. If Jackson's army got there first, he would be between the two, and therefore able to deal with them one at a time. Defensively, too, the position was a sound one. If Fremont attempted an advance on Stanton, Jackson would be on his flank. Or if Shields somehow managed to cross the South Fork and marched toward a junction at Harrisonburg, he could then be served in the same fashion. Or if everything went wrong and disaster loomed, Jackson could make a quick getaway by moving southeast through Brown's Gap, as he had done the month before on his roundabout march to fight the Battle of McDowell. All this was much, but mainly he prized the offensive advantages of the position, which would put his army between Fremont and Shields, with a chance to strike at one or the other, or both. Resuming the march that afternoon, he dispatched 2 mounted details to perform 2 separate but allied tasks, one to burn the bridge at Conrad's store, the other to establish a signal station on the southernmost peak of Massanutten Mountain. The first would frustrate Shields when he attempted to turn west. The second would observe his reaction. Meanwhile, fed and rested, each man carrying 2 days' cooked rations and a fresh supply of ammunition on his person, the main body made good time up the turnpike. The rain had slacked to a drizzle, which meant that Fremont would soon be able to recommission his pontoon bridge, but for the present the valley soldiers enjoyed an unmolested march. After stopping for the night just short of Harrisonburg, they entered that place next morning, June 5th, and turned southeast toward Port Republic and the execution of Stonewall's design. As soon as they left the turnpike, they encountered what Shields had to cope with all along, Napoleon's fifth element, mud. Presently it became obvious that they were not much better at coping with the stuff than they had been on the nightmare march near here 5 weeks ago. By nightfall, the head of the column was approaching North River, but the tail was no more than a mile from Harrisonburg. while the rest of the army was strung out along the 6 or 7 intervening miles of boggy road. Jackson's wrath was mollified, however, by the return of the detail he had sent to Conrad's store. They had won the race and done their job. From the signal station high on Massanutten came a message that Shields had halted 2 miles north of the burned bridge, which placed him 14 muddy miles from Port Republic. Fremont was a good deal farther back. He had crossed North Fork above Mount Jackson, but the cavalry was hacking away at the head of his column, impeding his progress up the pike. Reassured, though still regretful, Stonewall called a halt. The rain had slacked to a mizzle by now. Perhaps tomorrow the road would be firmer. It was. Saturday, after an early start, Ewell's division stopped just beyond the hamlet of Cross Keys, 6 miles from Harrisonburg, to stand in Fremont's path when he came up. Jackson's plodded another 3 miles and went into position on the heights above the confluence of the rivers at Port Republic, overlooking the low-lying opposite bank of the South Fork, where the road wound southwest from Conrad's store. This would be Shields's line of advance, and the guns on the heights would enfilade his column at close range. Neither of the Union forces was yet in sight, however, so the Valley soldiers had time for reading their mail, which had just been forwarded along with the latest newspapers. Elated by their victories, the editors had broken out their blackest type. The Charleston Mercury called Stonewall a true general, and predicted that he would soon be leading his unconquerable battalions through Maryland into Pennsylvania. By way of contrast, gloomy reports from the Northern press were reprinted in adjoining columns, and the Richmond Whig combined a mock protest with a backhand swipe at the administration. "This man Jackson must be suppressed, or else he will change the humane and Christian policy of the war and demoralize the government." The men, of course, enjoyed this flood of praise. Jackson, too, had an ache for fame, an ambition boundless as Cromwell's, Taylor called it, and as merciless. But he considered this a spiritual infirmity on becoming a Christian and a deacon of the Presbyterian Church. Also, he was pained that the glory was not ascribed to its true source, God Almighty. Members of his staff observed that from this time on he gave up reading the papers, perhaps for the same reason he had given up drinking whiskey. "Why, sir, because I like the taste of it, and when I discovered that to be the case, I made up my mind to do without it altogether." Included in the packet of mail was a congratulatory letter in the handwriting of the president. Congressman Butler delivered Jackson's request for more troops. Davis regretted that none were available. "Were it practicable to send you reinforcements, it should be done, and your past success shows how surely you would, with an adequate force, destroy the wicked designs of the invader of our homes and assailer of our political rights." For the present, however, the chief executive added, "It is on your skill and daring that reliance is to be placed. The army under your command encourages us to hope for all which men can achieve." Welcome though the praise was, the letter itself was disappointing. Without substantial reinforcements, Jackson knew he could not hope to drive Shields and Fremont from the valley as he had driven Banks. In fact, unless they came against him in his present strong position, which seemed unlikely considering their caution, neither was yet in sight, he could scarcely even hope to give them a prod. So he began thinking of alternatives, including the possibility of taking his little army down to the peninsula for a knockout combination against his old academy classmate, McClellan. Replying that same day, not to Davis, but to Johnston, who he thought was still in charge despite his wound, Stonewall wrote, "Should my command be required at Richmond, I can be at Meacham's River Depot on the Central Railroad the second day's march, and part of the command can reach there the first day, as the distance is 25 miles. At present," he added, unhappy in the middle of what seemed to be a stalemate, "I do not see that I can do much more than rest my command and devote its time to drilling." In this he was much mistaken. He could, and indeed would have to do a great deal more, as he found out next morning in a most emphatic manner. Shields was a politician, having represented both Illinois and Minnesota in the U.S. Senate. But he was also a veteran of the Black Hawk War and a Mexico brigadier. A 56-year-old native of Tyrone County, Ireland, he had proved his fighting ability by whipping Jackson at Kernstown back in March. And now that his opponent's fame had risen, he was anxious to prove it again in the same way. From Conrad's store, where he had paused to let his division catch its breath near the end of its wearing march up the narrow valley, he sent two brigades forward along the right bank of the South Fork to explore the situation at Port Republic. Stonewall was there already and might launch a sudden attack across the river, so Shields sent a message requesting cooperation from Fremont, whose guns he had been hearing intermittently for a week. "If he attempts to force a passage, as my force is not large there yet, I hope you will thunder down on his rear. I think Jackson is caught this time." He very nearly was, quite literally. The valley chieftain had spent the night at Port Republic, saddened by the death of his cavalry commander, Brigadier General Turner Ashby, who had fallen that afternoon in a skirmish just this side of Harrisonburg. Ashby had had his faults, the main one being an inability to keep his troopers on the job when there was loot or applejack within reach. But he had established a reputation for personal bravery that was never outdone by any man in either army. In death, the legend was complete. "Charge, men! For God's sake, charge!" he cried as he took the bullet that killed him. Now only the glory remained. "As a partisan officer, I never knew his superior," Jackson declared. Next morning, June 8th, when the chief of staff, a theologian who, conditions permitting, did double duty by preaching Sunday sermons in the camps, inquired if there would be any military operations today, Stonewall told him there would not. "You know I always try to keep the Sabbath if the enemy will let me." The men put no stock in this at all. Convinced by now that Jackson thought he enjoyed an advantage when fighting on the Lord's Day, they believed that he did so every time he got the chance. Statistics seemed to bear them out, and presently this statistical trend was strengthened. As the minister major went back into the house to compose his sermon and the rest of the staff prepared to ride out for an inspection of the camp on the northward ridge, a rattle of musketry shattered the Sunday morning stillness, and a cavalryman came galloping with alarming news. The Federals had forded South River, scattering the pickets, and were entering the town. "Go back and fight them," Jackson snapped. He mounted and rode hard for the North River Bridge, clattering across the long wooden structure just in time. A colonel and a lieutenant who brought up the rear were cut off and captured. Gaining the heights which overlooked the town, Jackson ordered his batteries to open fire on the bluecoats in the streets below, and sent two brigades of infantry to clear them out at the point of the bayonet. It was smartly done. The Federals fell back in haste, abandoning a field piece and the prisoners they had taken. Stonewall, peering down from the ridge as his men advanced across the bridge and through the smoke that hung about the houses, dropped the reins on his horse's neck and lifted both hands above his head, palms outward. When the men looked up and saw him stark against the sky, invoking the blessing of the God of battle, they cheered with all their might. The roar of it reached him there on the heights, and the cannoneers swelled the chorus. As the cheering subsided, the men on the ridge became aware of a new sound, the rumble and boom of cannon swelling from the direction of Cross Keys. It was Fremont, responding to Shields's request that he thunder down. Going forward, however, he struck not Jackson's rear, but Ewell's front. The first contact, after a preliminary bombardment, was on the Confederate right, where Ewell had posted a Virginia brigade along a low ridge overlooking some fields of early grain. Fremont came on with unaccustomed vigor, a regiment of New Yorkers in the lead, their boots crunching the young stalks of buckwheat. As they started up the slope, there was a sudden crash of gunfire from the crest, and the air was full of bullets. A second volley thinned the ranks of the survivors as they tried to reform their shattered line. They fell back, what was left of them. Fremont, reverting to the form he had shown at Strasbourg, settled down to long-range fighting with his artillery, which was skillfully handled. Out in the buckwheat, the wounded New Yorkers lay under this fire, crying for water. Their cries decreased as the day wore on, and Fremont continued his cannonade. In essence, that was all there was to the Battle of Cross Keys. Ewell, fretting because he could not get the Pathfinder to make another attack, at last pushed forward for more than a mile until he occupied the ground from which the Federals had advanced that morning. There he stopped, having been warned not to put too much space between the two wings of the army. Fremont, with 10,500 infantry effectives, faded back before Ewell's 5,000. It was finished. The North had lost 684 men, nearly half of them lying dead of their wounds in the grain fields. The South had lost 288, only 41 of them killed. Jackson's trust in Old Baldhead was confirmed. Except for a quick ride out to see how things were going, he had let Ewell fight his own battle while he himself remained on the heights above Port Republic. Asked if he did not think there was some danger that Shields would advance to help Fremont, whose guns were within earshot, Stonewall gestured toward his batteries and said grimly, "No, sir, no, he cannot do it. I should tear him to pieces." As he stood there, listening to the sound of Ewell's battle, intoxicated as if by music, he remarked to his ministerial chief of staff, "Major, wouldn't it be a blessed thing if God would give us a glorious victory today?" One who overheard him said that as he spoke, he wore the expression of a child hoping to receive some favor. But, childlike, having received it, he was by no means satisfied. He wanted more. That night he issued orders for Ewell to leave a reinforced brigade in front of Fremont and march the rest of his division through Port Republic to join the other wing for a combined assault on the Union troops beyond the river. Once Shields was properly broken up, they could both return and fall on Fremont, completing the destruction Ewell had begun today. The march began at earliest dawn of what was to be a lovely sun-drenched day. Jackson's division came down off the heights, crossed the North River Bridge, filed through the town, and forded South River. The Stonewall Brigade was in the lead, under 33-year-old Brigadier General Charles S. Winder, a tall, wavy-haired Maryland West Pointer who, by strict discipline and a resolute bearing under fire, had gained the respect of his men, despite their resentment at losing Garnet. For an hour, the advance up the right bank of the South Fork continued. Then at 7 o'clock, word came back that Federal pickets had been encountered. Jackson studied the situation briefly, then told Winder to go ahead and drive them. He did not know the enemy's strength, but he believed more would be gained by a sudden assault than by a detailed reconnaissance of the position. Besides, Ewell would soon be coming up, and Stonewall wanted to get the thing over with quickly so as to return and deal with Fremont before the Pathfinder, discovering the weakness of the force to his front, pushed it back into Port Republic and burned the bridge. Winder went forward, driving hard, but entered a maelstrom of bullets and shells that stopped the charge in its tracks. Once more, as at Kernstown against these same men, Jackson's old brigade had to pay in blood for his rashness. What was worse, by way of indignity, though he did not know it, there were only two small brigades before him, fewer than 3,000 soldiers, but they made up in fury and grit for what they lacked in numbers. Their commander, Brigadier General E.B. Tyler, had placed 6 of his 16 guns in a lofty charcoal clearing on his left. While the Blue Infantry held in front, these guns delivered a rapid and accurate fire, enfilading the stalled ranks of the attackers. Winder sent 2 regiments to flank and charge the battery, but they were met by volleys of grape and flung back with heavy losses. All this time the Stonewall Brigade was being decimated, its ranks plowed by shells from the guns in the coaling. Jackson was dismayed, seeing his hopes dissolve in the boil and swirl of gun smoke. Fremont by now must have attacked in response to the uproar, and Ewell was nowhere in sight. It seemed likely that McDowell might be coming up with the rest of his 20,000 troops, in which case there was nothing to do but concentrate everything against him for a decisive battle right here, or else retreat and put a sorry ending to the month-long Valley campaign. Stonewall chose the former course, sending couriers to hasten Ewell's march and inform the holding force at Cross Keys to fall back through Port Republic, burning the North River Bridge behind them so that Fremont, at least, would be kept out of the action. Meanwhile, Winder must hang on. His men were wavering, almost out of ammunition, but he held them there, perhaps remembering what had happened to his predecessor after falling back from a similar predicament. Presently, the unaccustomed frown of fortune changed suddenly to a smile. Taylor appeared, riding at the head of his Louisianians. He had marched toward the sound of firing. Jackson greeted him with suppressed emotion, saying calmly, "Delightful excitement." Taylor looked at the hard-pressed front, then off to the right, where smoke was boiling up from the hilltop clearing. If those guns were not silenced soon, he said, the army might have an indigestion of such fun. Stonewall agreed and gave him the job. While Taylor was setting out to perform it, the valley commander joined Winder, whose men were dropping fast along the front. From his horseback perch, Jackson saw enemy skirmishers beginning to creep forward. Quickly, he ordered a charge, hoping to shock them into caution until Taylor reached their flank. The Stonewall Brigade